Welcome to the Career Transition Podcast. My name is Nana Bohendi, and I am a master career coach. I absolutely love helping people land jobs that they love. And, you know, something that I haven't mentioned in my previous episode is that types of people that I absolutely love helping, my favorite, are usually people who don't fit in a particular category or box in terms of success. I call them underdogs sometimes, but they're not in a way because they have a lot of wisdom and life experiences. They may not have had the title. They may not have had the degree, but they're amazing people. And those are the types of people that I love helping. So part of helping you get into roles that you may have thought you've never been able to get to is create a very strong personal brand. And so today I am going to break the anatomy of a perfect resume and help you learn how to build an awesome resume for yourself so that you can sell your value. And today I have with me John, who's going to facilitate the conversation.
Thanks for having me back and to have this conversation on resumes, because you promised last episode that you would make this fun, and it's really starting to become fun because you're breaking it down in such digestible ways that may seem kind of obvious, but a lot of the times we're not thinking about it because we're in the thick of trying to figure out what our resume is supposed to look like or say or all the other stuff, whereas you're giving us an objective perspective, which is so cool. Now, you mentioned the perfect resume. It makes me think of this meme. You know how there's a meme that says the perfect blank doesn't exist, and then like dot, dot, dot. And so it's kind of like the perfect resume doesn't exist, except it does, because you're going to tell us about the perfect resume. So take it away.
Yes. So here's my attempt to try to visualize this, but I'm going to go about it from the perspective and the psychology of a recruiter, because after all, that's who we're addressing. And when a recruiter is very busy and has to scan through a pile, they're not going to read every single word. And so one of the big pet peeves that I've heard from recruiters say is having too many bullets. And I've seen that a lot, where people just have their position, the company name, and then list a whole laundry list of bullets. The thing about bullets is they're used to emphasize important things. And when you're telling a recruiter that every single thing is important, then nothing is important to them. They're just not going to bother. And so the way I like to teach people to write resumes is to have the company name and then their title along with the date. We have the date usually very close to the title using a comma rather than to the side and the edge of the page, because we don't want the eyes to overly focus on the dates, which tends to not be favorable to the candidate because they can be judged for the duration or the amount of time they spent at an organization. So that's one piece. The second piece is I like to have a why me section, usually on the left side of the resume. It stand out. It's like an executive summary. It's kind of like picking up a book, reading the back of the book, and getting the gist of what's going to be covered in the book. That should be your hook. Now, I see a lot of people getting overly fancy with their why me sections. I have dogs and hobbies, and I play hockey and all kinds of things. And you got to understand, as much as I advocate for people to be their authentic selves and bring in their personalities, you need to understand that there's a time and place for that. You bring that with you to the interview. But from a resume perspective, you only have one shot to qualify yourself. And the way you are going to be assessed is going to be in a very factual manner. Did you do these things or did you not do them? Period. So don't waste time talking about all the other fluff that you did, and make sure that you address the criteria within the job posting. So I actually have a number of tricks to write the why me section. And one of the tricks is to use FBI negotiator Chris Voss's mirroring technique. Mirror the language of the job posting look at it, read it, highlight portions that make sense, and incorporate it and use them to frame what you have done. I would, you know, max it out to 3 paragraphs, basically. Now, the body of the resume. You have every single position, you know, you've done in the past 10 years around with the role and the dates. Now, what else do you put in? The format should be paragraph, bullets. A paragraph that describes what you've done that they can quickly scan through. And then the bullets should be proof of success. The so what, the wins, what have you achieved? And by having that different categorization, it creates a wonderful user experience for the recruiter because now they can differentiate what you've done from the impact that you've created. And of course, your education should actually be in the second page at the very bottom of the resume. Because if you are an experienced professional, you're going to be evaluated based on what you've done, not you know, your education or schooling as much. Versus if you're a new grad, then sure, you don't have a lot of experience, so that's what you need to rely on. So the big mistake is when I see the education right at the top instead of all the way to at the bottom in the second page. And then the last thing is the skills section. So especially if you are in tech, you got to list all the tools that are common to your trade. And how you know what tools to include is look at job postings and see what keeps popping up and make sure that they're there. And then you can also include also the buzzwords, your expertise, you know, frameworks that you're familiar with, whatever that is common in your profession. So that pretty much sums up the entire winning architecture of the resume. And the last thing I'll say is there's this whole debate between should I have a 1-pager or 2-pager? So I'm going to destroy that, okay? I'm going to destroy that myth of how you just need a 1-pager. People have got to stop this. Because the thing is, especially if you have over a decade of experience, if you try to cram everything into 1 page, you're giving shallow information. You're not giving specific information. And as I mentioned, you know, in the previous episode, it's better to be specific. You can still be specific and concise. So 2 pages is the magic number. If you're below VP level, then definitely 2 pages. And if you're above, you know, entry level. So anywhere in between has to be 2 pages. Entry level and VP level, 1-pager. VP level because you're going to be talking to the CEO and they're more concerned about your executive, you know, roles and diving deep into it. And entry level because there's just not much to put on there to fill 2 pages.
So good. Thank you for leading us through the perfect resume because I think all these different parts are really important. And sometimes we don't really place things in the right order because we think something's important when actually to recruiters, they're not so important. Now, going back to then the 1-pager, 2-pager, all the different things related to experience, tell us a little bit more about building our story.
Yes. So I use my story building framework to help people extract their experiences. Because it's just the perfect framework to ensure that we're targeting everything, not just what you've done, but the context on what type of problem you're solving. When we talk about the situation that you were in on the project, what your role was, what are some of the challenges and the obstacles that you faced? What are some of the actions that you took and what was the impact? And so it is such a great framework to do a brain dump of what you've done. Just get the juices going. The biggest mistake that I see people make is they try to get the wordsmithing perfect in the resume instead of just doing a brain dump. You're not going to be able to write a beautifully written resume with good language and address the requirements all in one shot. Why do you do that? It's like when you're writing a book, first you have to get the ideas out of your head. So actually, the frameworks that we use for interviews, if you think about it, your interview answers should really be in some shape or form can be used in your resume. Why reinvent the wheel? In fact, when I work with clients, I get them to write stories about their projects. We don't go too deep for the resume, but then we build upon them for the interviews. And that ends up saving a ton of time.
Plus, I would imagine that when it's laid out so well in the resume, it leaves the person wanting more, which then they'll ask for more of the story, which then the candidate is ready to tell more because the entire story has been prepared.
Exactly. And a little tidbit that I give, and I encourage people to listen, tune into the storytelling, you know, episode that we filmed, but just to kind of give a quick review, the things that you want to talk about in your resume, the stories that you want people to read about you on your resume should be transformation stories. And what I mean by that, any time that you made a change in the organization and some type of improvement, that's what you should include on the resume. Not like, oh, day-to-day routine stuff. That's boring as heck. No one cares that you built a spreadsheet and did all that. What they care about is I came up with this new idea and it created this impact. And now I'm sure people's imposter syndrome is going to go off and say, oh my God, I didn't do anything amazing. You don't have to have launched a rocket to the moon as long as you changed something and it created a favorable outcome to the organization. Talk about it.
Which then really leads us to the best part and the part that people really struggle with, which is quantifying this impact. So as if imposter syndrome wasn't enough and we didn't feel like we actually really had the impact, a lot of times we don't know how to quantify the impact. So how do you go about that, Nana?
Absolutely. So the way I guide people in terms of quantifying the impact is I remind them that at the end of the day, companies want to hire people who impact their bottom line, okay? So if what you're doing in some shape or form does not have that domino effect where it improves the company's profitability, improves their ability to acquire clients, improve their ability to retain clients, create some kind of loyalty or improve the quality of the product, then what you're doing is not impactful, okay? So you got to think of it from that perspective. So the profitability triangle that I share with people is composed of three elements. In order to create profit or improve the bottom line, there are three things that you need to do. Either you are going to save time, and by saving time, that translates to money, or you're going to reduce cost, right? Which ends up, again, increasing the profitability, right? Simple equation. If you decrease the cost and keep the revenue the same, you're increasing the profit margin for the organization. And then the quality. Anything that you've done that contributed to a better quality on your team, whether it's the quality of the process, which ends up translating to eventually to the quality of the product that the companies are going to use or service. If you are doing things in a less amount of time, maybe you introduced an automation, maybe you were part of a product that automated manual processes. Think about that. Ask yourself, what were things like before you were involved in these projects? Maybe you were working on something that was taking, let's say, a business stakeholder 30 hours. Maybe they were pulling reports by spending 30 hours pulling the data. And now you came up with a tool or you contributed to a tool that ended up replacing those 30 hours with one click of a button, right? So you need to ask yourself these questions in order to be able to quantify. How many hours before I was involved in this project was it taking, you know, users? How many now? And then come up with a percentage, right? So that's how I advise people to approach it. And there is a formula, basically, that I give people once they come up with these achievements and maybe this is a little bit of an information overload, but usually we start with a verb like increased, let's say, revenue. We put in the dollar value. By how much did you increase it? And then by doing what? So another example, decrease cost, let's say by $10,000. So I'm giving the exact number. By, for example, automating processes, right? Mm. So that is the formula of writing an achievement. You need to come up with by how much, you know, what is the impact have you created? By how much did you decrease the cost? By how much did you increase the revenue? You retained a customer that was valued at $10,000 or whatever. And then how did you do that? That's the piece mm-hmm. of the puzzle. The impact quantified and how you created the impact. Now, one more thing I wanted to say is, again, people's imposter syndrome is going to go off and say, well, I didn't do this on my own. I was part of a team. Yes, no one does anything at a company on their own. Even the CEO, he or she relies on a team. So you need to talk about your part of the puzzle. Right?
So, yes, so good. I agree. And by talking about that, then people, the interviewer will be like, oh, tell me more. And this is a really good opportunity to really then deep dive during the interview, which is so, so smart. So everyone listening right now, I'm sure it wasn't information overload. It was a perfect amount of information because we really need to know these things in order to work on it. But in the same way that we could probably describe how to dismantle a car engine or something, it's one thing to know the information and another thing to be able to do or have somebody walking you through it. This is why Nada not only is doing this podcast and giving all of this information, but she also runs a program or a course that will walk you through all these different things, including knowing what questions to ask so that you can quantify the right impact that will make you stand out compared to the other candidates who are applying for the same job as well. So if you found this helpful, then share this with a friend who's kind of going through something similar, or reach out to Nada on LinkedIn to ask her about more of these things, because there's so much to go into. And if you're curious whether you qualify to apply for the program, check out the link below so that you can really put together the perfect resume. This was a whole point of these last two episodes, which is curating your experience and by building your resume. And it's so important.
Yes.
Okay. Nada, we're going to jump into the questions from your community, unless you have something else to end with.
No, I think we're ready to get into the questions.
Amazing. Now, all of these questions from all of these episodes are questions that have been brought up by Nada's community. So not only when you work with her, you get the mentorship and the guidance and all the information of what to do, you also get to join a community where other people have worked with her and you guys can help each other and also encourage each other through the entire journey of finding a new job or going through a career transition. So the first question that was asked on this topic was, do you need to align your resume to the job every time you apply? This sounds like an interesting question.
Yes. So, all right. So I see a lot of people who have like 10 different versions of their resume, and that's not a good thing.
Ooh.
Yeah. And this is why I spend upfront time with clients identifying their ideal job, even if they know that this is the profession that they want to get into. We still have to dial into what type of organization, what type of industry, what level, what combination of things that they want to do or spend more time on. This is why it's important to identify what we call an MVP job or a model job based on a job posting. Because again, we have a set of criteria that we can align to. Okay. When we do that, we end up having what I call a baseline resume. Because at the end of the day, if it is the same, if it is, you know, the same role that you're applying to, whether it's Scrum Master, Project Manager, I mean, at the end of the day, all the job postings are going to have 70% of the common tasks repeated over and over again. Now, there's going to be like 30% or 20% that's going to vary across the roles. And the analogy that I give, it's like there are different flavors of cookies. But at the end of the day, the base of the cookie, the recipe, the proportion of flour, what makes it a cookie instead of a cake is going to be the same, right? It's only going to be like, oh, are we, the toppings are maybe going to be different. The flavor is going to be different. So amongst the job postings, depending on the organization, the flavor is going to be different. But the base, the 70% of what they ask you to do and what makes, what defines the role is going to stay the same. And so this will save you time and you're only going to have to adjust the 20 or the 30%. Maybe you'll have to add a few words here and there because this is a different industry. So rather than maybe putting in your projects that are related to health, maybe you'll put your projects, you'll focus on the projects that are related to financial services, right? So that's where you have to do minimal alignment. And I have cheat sheets that I give my clients that they can follow in order to make these alignments. And with practice, it ends up only taking them 20 minutes to align their resume versus spending hours building a new one from scratch every time they apply for a job.
Wow. So helpful. I mean, in this process is already arduous enough to have to look for different opportunities. And I think people feel very emotionally drained. So the fact that you can give somebody such a tool to make it easier makes such a big difference. This kind of goes into question two a little bit, because there are some adjustments or ways of wording things that's really important. You kind of touched on this before, but I'd love for you to get into a little bit deeper. The question says, what if you were never part of something that was launched or completed? How do you represent your achievement?
I get that a lot from many, many clients. And I've experienced this myself, where I spent a huge majority of my corporate life working on programs that got shut down due to funding issues. And we never get to launch the product or complete the project. If you think about it, there are a lot of successful people working at companies like Facebook and Google, you know, who work on experimental products that never get launched because, you know, the organization realizes that it's not worth it. For example, if you think of Google Glasses, right? There was an actual team of engineers that were working on that and they shut it down. And what happened to these engineers, right? They never got to finish it. Are they going to go in an interview and feel like failures because they didn't launch it? They still gained a lot of experience working on it and they learned a lot of lessons. So I would not feel like you shouldn't include those projects on your resume. And I would think of the micro wins. The win does not always have to be the product got launched. The win could be that maybe you found an efficient way to do something while you were working with your team. Maybe even the fact that you realized that this was a project that was not worth it and you stopped the company from continuing further. So I would stay away from that thinking of I never got to be part of a project from concept to launch, and therefore my experience is not worth including.
Mm-hmm. I also just wonder whether we have no idea what we're working on in a certain thing that has not been launched might impact other things that are being developed later. Just because this one thing doesn't get launched doesn't mean the technology doesn't go, or the processes, or the whatever was discovered doesn't go to another project. So I love how you broke this down so well. Question three that came from your community asked, what if you don't have access to the dollar values or numbers?
Yes, not everyone is a project manager and has access to the financials when they work on projects. So people then say, I don't know how to quantify this because no one shared with me what the dollar value of this project is or how much money we made off of this project with clients. Some of the information is even confidential, especially if you are working for, let's say, a VC or a startup, here's what I advise you to do. First of all, I worked with a client who came from the world of academia as a professor in an environment where things were usually not measured, or their performance was not measured, and we were able to quantify what she's done.
Okay. Wow.
Questions like, usually when I work with clients, I ask them questions like, okay, in that client situation, I asked her, how many students were you teaching? And she would say, well, 200 in a semester. I'm like, basically, you had two hundred clients that you were working with. That shows that you're able to hold a room of 200 people. Those factual pieces of data really helps crystallize and helps a recruiter gain a factual understanding of how much you can handle and the level of complexity.
Mm.
So using those numbers was beneficial in her case. And then I asked her, okay, so out of those 200 people, how many were attending your classes, right? And so if the engagement, or if, you know, she was getting 100% attendance or close to 100 every time she was holding that class, that means she's able to have a high engagement level in her classes. That means she's a very effective facilitator. And so we were able to quantify that number and say, okay, I achieved 90% engagement in my class. So it doesn't have to always be dollar value. Think, ask yourself, what is definition of success look like for me in my job?
Yes. Yes.
And is there a way that I can demonstrate that, right? Another example with my, for example, scrum masters, right?
Mm.
A question I asked one of my scrum masters was, how many features on average were your team committing to at the beginning of the sprint?
Mm-hmm.
And how many at the end did they deliver? Was it 50, 70, 80, 90%? That shows that you're such an effective, you know, scrum master that you were able to get your team to deliver most of what they promised that they would deliver. So
yep.
There's a million examples, and I usually give people a cheat sheet to basically come up with their achievements with a list of questions that can help them think. But
yes,
those are just examples right there on how to quantify the impact that you've created.
Hmm. Guys, this is why you work with a coach. There are things that we just don't know because we don't know. There are things we don't see because we don't see it. Working with somebody who's experienced and knows how to extract the things out of your experience is what makes all the difference, be able to get that interview or not, or get that job or not. So if you're interested in working with Nada, or if you have any questions about this episode, go to the link below. Her LinkedIn information is right there. Follow her, connect with her, send her a DM if you have any questions, and ask about what this program is, and really find out how your life is going to be changed. As you've heard from previous episodes, people have been able to land dream jobs that were not even in the scope of what they were thinking. And this is the cool, magical thing about working with a career consultant, which is so much fun. Nada, thank you for all of your generous sharing today. And you just provided so much value in this episode.
Thank you so much, John.
It's the success.
Not only to think, but to act outside of the box.
You need a coach to help guide you on what your sweet spot is.
What you do works, period.